Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona Shaw, we're back.
We're back. And we've just been to the latest IIUSA meeting in Washington, D.C., where we heard Charlie's great revelations last Monday.
Yeah, great revelations indeed. In fact, frequent listeners to the show may be wondering, you know, it's been a couple weeks since we've released an episode. Truth be told, we had an episode, we've recorded it, and we were just about to publish, and Charlie Oppenheim comes out and gives us some conflicting information than what we essentially recorded. So I think we made the responsible decision, like, hey, let's pull that, let's not publish it, and let's move on from there.
That's right, Mark. We really do value quality control and the accuracy of the information that we give out on this podcast. I do realize that a lot of our listeners do rely on us. So it's very, very important for us to give you the correct information.
That's right. I mean, almost 80 episodes. Sure, if you go way deep into our backlog, some of the information has changed over time, but the insight really doesn't change. But when we release information and it changes almost like the next day, we got to do the responsible thing and just pull that. So, you know, Mona, not only am I the co-host of the show, but I also listen to it. And listen to our past few episodes, you know, I was thinking to myself, if I was an Indian or Chinese national, you know, I would start to think that the doors to the U.S. are closing. Are you getting that feel?
Right, Mark. It would seem that following Charlie's latest revelations, again, at the IIUSA annual event in Washington, D.C., I think for this would be a wonderful opportunity to introduce our guest so that we can really talk about Charlie's revelations and credible alternatives to the backlog issue.
That's right, Mona. Today's guest is Rohit Turkud. Rohit has been practicing the U.S. immigration and nationality law since 1985 and has specialized in employment-based immigration for a great majority of that time. Rohit was a contributing author of The Perm Book and is a frequent speaker on business immigration issues. For well over 6 years, Rohit hosted a primetime live immigration show on a national cable network channel. Now, he's adding to all these great accomplishments as a guest on EB5 Investment Voice. Rohit, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mark, and thank you, Mona. And as you correctly said, one of my crowning achievements is now to be on Mona's podcast. Fabulous. Much appreciate being invited and having the privilege to share some of my thoughts.
Just to remind our audience as to who Charlie Oppenheim is. Charlie Oppenheim is the chief of the Visa Controls Office at the U.S. Department of State. He's the one with the magic wand who is able to adjust, usually, the visas to the countries. However, even Charlie has limitations, right, Rohit?
Absolutely. And I was just going to say that his magic wand is not infallible.
Yes.
That's for sure. He does provide us some very interesting insights, which unfortunately sometimes, I wouldn't use the word whimsical, but certainly are subject to change at even very short notice.
Short notice to the point where we have to cancel an episode release.
Right. Well, there were some devastating revelations on Monday. We were not all that surprised to know that India will finally have its own final action date, but though we were expecting it to perhaps be in October or November of this year, and not as early as June or early July.
And probably, Mona, if I may add, probably not the kind of wait that he has predicted. Even if it's supposed to be a worst case scenario, I don't think any of us had expected an 8+ year potential wait before one qualifies to even apply for a conditional residency for Indian born applicants.
Right. That's, again, just for Indian born applicants. Unfortunately, the clock didn't even move very far for the Chinese applicants either. In fact, for Chinese applicants, and we have all these on our blog, listeners, if you do want to have a take a look at the charts, for Chinese, it's moved to 16.3 years if you were to apply today.
Yeah, and with India having suddenly now a wait period of potentially 8.4 versus about 5.3 or 5.4, which is what Charlie had predicted almost exactly a year ago, there are certainly many, many questions that come up to you and to I from Chinese and Indian investors without a question. And I think that puts us back to the question that you just, that you'd raised right in the beginning. What would you do if you're an Indian or a Chinese? Are the doors slamming behind you?
Well, the reason I think we have to say that is because of the traditional path for both Indian and Chinese has been EB2s and EB3s, which is deployment-based category. And on Monday, Charlie had stated that for EB2, EB3, for India, we're talking about 50. That's 50 years plus. He thought 50 was a good estimate.
Absolutely. Compared to an article that had been published maybe about a month ago, which actually did speak about about 150 years as a waiting timeline for EB2s. I think we all agreed that we'd all be long dead before that kind of priority date came into being.
I know. I shouldn't laugh about it, but it is like, it's so ridiculous. It just doesn't, it defies belief. But in any event, we have been talking about visa relief for EB5 for some time, and we hope to see it this year. But just in case it doesn't come this year and it comes next year, Rohit, we have to see, what do we do if we're an Indian or a Chinese national?
I think I'd begin with taking a deep breath, first of all, because the doors have not closed. The doors are not closing. I see it as a clearly potential delay, but not a stop sign over there. It's a yield, not a stop, the way I look at it.
Right. So don't run off to Canada. Don't run off to New Zealand or Australia or Britain just yet.
Absolutely. And if the US is your final destination, all the others are simply pit stops, and pit stops may have pitfalls. So I would kind of stay with the United States, and I would say that's where I want to go. Anything else is simply along the way. That's the way I see it.
Right. Rohit, we get asked this question over and over and over again from people, mostly H-1B holders who are in this country, that once I file the EB-5, do I get an EAD?
So I think that's a very clear answer. This is not one of those gray areas. And you and I both have this conversation on a fairly regular basis. Filing the 526, which is the form for the EB-5, does not give you any rights to remain in the United States. It does not give you any rights to work in the United States. So there's no employment authorization by virtue of simply filing the 526. In fact, I'm going to stretch that logic and reality a little further and say you don't have the right to remain in the United States until you actually file the adjustment of status application, and you don't have the right to legally work in the United States until you actually get the employment authorization document, which is issued approximately 90 to 100 days after you file the adjustment of status.
That's correct. However, concurrent filing, meaning that you will be allowed to get an EAD at the same time while your EB-5 is pending, is actually part of the new draft legislation. And it's also out there in the regs. So either we get the regs in or we get the new draft legislation, there is some hope.
Absolutely. And that's the reason why we all have our fingers and toes crossed. We're all trying to figure out how this is really going to work. Because if you go back to just the regular employment-based categories or even the family-based categories, I think it's traditionally been established that you can only file a concurrent adjustment of status application if your priority date is current, which I'm sure your listeners over the 80 pods and the podcast that you had are very familiar with that. So we don't need to get into that probably. But I think this would certainly be a very different way of processing EB-5 applications, especially for India, China, Vietnam, the ones who are backlogged, if they allow us to file concurrent adjustment of status applications with the I-526.
Right. But there is potential work authorization options. And Rohit, you're an expert in this area. You're an expert in employment-based immigration generally, but particularly in this area.
I would rather see experienced versus expert, because I think that's I'm treading very dangerous ground over there. But certainly we can look at the H-1B. That's been the forte of our law firm and our practice for years on end because of the number of IT companies that we represent. But the H-1B certainly, despite its limitations with the quotas and the challenges and the crazy RFEs that are being issued by the Immigration Service, does provide one of the most viable options to being in the United States and working in the United States, which may well be leading out from the F-1 and then the OPT. And we can discuss the OPT a little separately, Mona, because I'm sure you and I, again, both deal with that all the time. But the right. H-1 allows you to stay under the right circumstances indefinitely in the United States, work indefinitely in the United States. At some point in time, your spouse, who may otherwise not be allowed to work on an H-4, can also obtain work authorization, at least under the present circumstances. And that allows you to stay here and work. And I think the Fs and the Hs are the more common ones that we're seeing for the EB-5s.
But Rohit, I thought that H-1B applicants had a maximum of 6 years. And also, can you let our viewers know, is there a country quota for H-1s?
There is a global quota for H-1s. There's no country quota for H-1s. And I think, as Charlie actually reiterated on Monday, India has been using over 30% of the H-1B quota for many years. At some point in time, may have been 2 or 3 years ago, when there was some data released, you could see that India was using more than 30% of the H-1s, and the next biggest users were in the single digits. So there's no question that India dominates on the H-1 side. And maybe that's one of the reasons why there are so many RFEs and why there is so much of, for lack of a better word, I'm going to say dislike of the H-1B IT sector from India. That's definitely there. Indians are using it. You raised a question over here, Mona, about whether there is a 6-year limit on the H-1s. You're absolutely right. There is. But the AC-21 rules and regulations do allow you to extend the H-1 almost indefinitely when you have an approved I-140. Again, for most of your listeners, that's an employment-based petition which gets approved by the immigration after the labor certification, which is the test of the U.S. labor market, has been approved by the Labor Department. You can also extend it for limited periods of time when the labor certification application has been pending for at least a year. So the immigration laws are relatively generous in extending your H-1 beyond the 6 years.
So Rohit, if we file an EB-5, so I have a client who's on an H-1B, and he doesn't really want to waste time doing an I-140 with a 50-plus year backlog. Would he just be able to have an extension, a 6-year extension on his H-1B if he just filed EB-5?
No. He's got to have a basis for extending. So I think your client would be best served by discussing with you and seeking your advice on filing the I-140. It's important for the client to remember as well that the I-140 has to be filed within 180 days of the approval of the perm application. If you don't do that, the perm application essentially becomes useless. So you would have to file, and that would be his basis for getting extensions of the H-1 for 3 years at a time into eternity, if necessary. So just filing the EB-5 is not going to help the client, because it's not giving him permission to remain in the absence of a valid visa, or work, again, in the absence of a valid visa.
So here we have somebody who has considered EB-5, who's here on an H-1. He's considered EB-5 and said, oh, look, I'm not going to wait in any backlog, even if I'm thinking that the backlogs may not happen. So I'll just stay on my I-140 if I can just stay here into eternity, as you have just stated. However, my children are now 19 and 20. What about them? Will they be able to stay here in eternity, or does something happen to my children?
Ouch. I guess your question wasn't quite as simple as I thought it might be. You've now got a whole different issue of the Child Status Protection Act. I think that's one of those situations which I'm sure you've discussed with your client. And it's one of those situations where you really want the Immigration Service to take as long as possible to adjudicate your 526, the EB-5 application, because that may be the best protection for your children. You also have the issue of how long is it taking to adjudicate the I-140, which may also be helpful under the CSPA. You probably do not want to premium process the I-140. You want to let that take as long as it can. And I'm sure that you and I both know the reasons for that. And I'm sure that you would do a perfectly great job explaining to the individual why you don't want to rush into getting the I-140 approved on a premium processing basis. And I think if the kid is 19, at the time of filing the EB-5 now, it's my thought, or rather my opinion, which I would love to be proven wrong in this situation, that the 19-year-old is not getting a green card through EB-5 in light of the processing times and the visa projections by Charlie on Monday. I'm not sure how you feel about it, though.
I'm very hopeful that we're going to get a solution by the end of this year or next year at the least. But yes,
you're definitely a greater optimist than I am. That's for sure. Yeah.
Well, as I said, I'm very confident that this whole removal of the dependents out of the quota will actually happen. But moving on, Rohit, I'm an Indian or a Chinese national. How can I get in? And what is the difference between coming in a non-immigrant status and coming in an immigrant status as far as time?
So non-immigrant status, also one would need to distinguish between different non-immigrant statuses. What I mean by that is if you're coming in as an F1, you clearly need to establish the satisfaction of the consular officers that you have a non-immigrant intent, meaning the intent to return to your home country after completing the studies or the purpose of that particular non-immigrant visa. The only two visas that allow you to have a dual intent would be the H1 and the L1. If you're coming as an F1, which is a starting point for most people coming into the United States, you do need to establish the non-immigrant intent. And I think in some countries, it is possible to do that, especially out of India. It is possible to do that. And during conversations with consular officers out of Chennai, out of Mumbai, out of Delhi, they have consistently said that if the individual applying for an F1 is a bona fide student going to a bona fide educational institution, we will not hold the EB-5, the pending or the filed EB-5 application against the individual's ability to establish the non-immigrant intent.
That's absolutely correct. We've actually managed to get this, we've had the consulate in Dubai to confirm this. And it's happened to several of our clients. Even though they filed EB-5, they've had their F1.
So. Correct, as have I. And that is very, very reassuring. So I think you start out with an F1 for most of the young folk over here. Before I proceed with that, I think I would like to just point out to your listeners which is really the fastest way to get the immigration benefit of migrating. And I do want to, on a more serious note, the first option that I'm going to simply mention is intended to be pursued in all good faith. And I'm talking about or referring to a marriage to a U.S. citizen. That is always the shortest way. Clearly, a 16-year-old would not be encouraged to do that. You would need to be age appropriate. Considering I've been doing this for a long time, I've seen people being taken out of the immigration office in handcuffs, being put under removal proceedings because the marriage was a sham. It was clearly never intended to be a marriage in the true sense and the honorable sense of the word. So when I say that you can migrate through marriage to an American citizen, I mean that it's got to be a real marriage. And I don't mean it's got to be forever, but the intention has to be forever, or at least for an indefinite period of time. So having just put that out for age-appropriate and properly qualified potential immigrants, I think that's enough said on the marriage front. But you clearly have the F1, which then hopefully if you have a STEM degree, Mona, I'm sure that that's one of the first questions you ask all your F1 clients. What kind of a degree are you pursuing?
Right.
Because you then have the possibility of a 3-year OPT versus a simple 1-year OPT. Then you hopefully get an H1 and you're then going towards the green card. Those are all paths to your ultimate goal of getting your green card. And to date, despite Charlie's somewhat depressing numbers and forecasts, I think EB-5 is still the best way to get to your ultimate goal of the green card.
It is. But we are looking at options for people to come into the country, maybe temporarily before their EB-5 has actually been adjudicated, or rather their visa number's there.
Right. So Of course, for people who are Canadian citizens, they have the TN visa. For Australian citizens, they'll have the E3. For Singapore citizens and Chilean citizens, they'll have the H1B1. What do you think of the O1 possibility, Mona, for citizens of India, China?
O1 is a good possibility because a lot of the people who do come in with an EB5 are high net worth or have some kind of substantial background. And an O1 provides work authorization for entrepreneurs who really have demonstrated extraordinary ability through their career. I mean, the extraordinary ability category is a harder category to get into, but it's not impossible. And as I said, many of our applicants who are EB5 qualified are able to get the O1. But Rohit, let me ask you a question. What about a J1 or what about a B1? I've heard some regional centers offering B1 visas.
I think you said something very, very important during our panel, Mona, where people are giving incorrect information. And you and I both agreed on the need to educate your listeners, your potential clients, your clients on the truth and the reality. And I think with all humility, I must confess that regional centers are not immigration lawyers. It kind of bothers me if a regional center says to somebody, oh, you can just come in on a B1. I'm not sure what that is supposed to imply or what message is conveyed. Because as you and I both know, on the B1, which is a visitor for business, the applicant or the visa holder is allowed to come into the United States and conduct their business. They're not allowed to work. They're not allowed to be employed. They're essentially required to be representing their foreign employer. So the B1 is limiting in terms of its stay and limiting in terms of the scope of what you can do during that time. And I'm not sure if it was on Charlie's panel or on another panel where they talked about the B1 being abused by some companies and may have been some validity to that. So the B1, I think, is limiting. I think you've got to be very careful with that. The J1 that you ask is certainly an exchange visitor visa, which is good for about 18 months. I think the J1 is fine, but in light of the prediction of how long it's going to take to get to the point of being able to even apply for adjustment of status, I'm not sure if the J1 is the answer or, again, one of the alphabets to the spelling of the green card. I think maybe that's what it is. And of course, as you and I would both be super worried about a J1 that has a 2-year home residency requirement,
right,
that may actually defeat the purpose of the J1 and the individual's ability or desire to simply not go back to China or not go back to India while they're waiting for their EB5.
Mona, what about the entrepreneur parole? I know that we had an episode on it a while back. How would that relate to this case?
Well, the International Entrepreneur Rule allows DHS to grant up to 5 years of parole and work authorization in 30-month increments to certain foreign entrepreneurs. There are a lot of conditions attached to that. For example, they have to work with a new startup, and there's a whole bunch of investment issues. However, I have to state this is really less favorable than a visa because the Trump administration is working to rescind this rule. It's very much an Obama time rule, and we don't know if it's going to go anywhere.
Well, it does have the name parole in it, so I get that.
Mona, that was great about the entrepreneurial parole, but the other visa that we hear a lot about these days, and I think you're pretty familiar with it from all my conversations and discussions with you, is the E1, E2. Does it apply to India and China? Does it make sense? And how are you making it work for them? What's the secret to your success on that?
Well, you know that Indian Chinese are not entitled to the E2 treaty visa because they're not treaty countries. So what has to happen, Rohit, is that they have to basically either marry somebody who has citizenship of that country.
Covered that.
Or obtain citizenship themselves. And the fastest way, which is really the flavor of the month right now, is obtaining a Caribbean passport. Then once they've obtained a Caribbean passport, they have the eligibility. And as you know, Indians are wonderful entrepreneurial people with businesses, and they are able to get E2s quite easily.
I love what you mentioned earlier about some of these countries are pit stops, but may have some pitfalls. And I could see where the Caribbean route may have some pitfalls as well. So I'm glad, Mona, you brought it up. And I know we've covered it deeply on a previous episode, but that's a good way, a good strategy on how to get E2 to apply to an Indian national.
I have a related question over here, Mona. And again, with your expertise, I think you are probably going to be able to shed some light. As you well know, there are currency restrictions out of India. How do you advise your investor clients to be able to fund the EB-5 investment and fund the Grenada option and fund the E-2?
Rohit, with that question, I have no other alternative but to invite you back, because that's a subject of an entire new podcast. Don't you agree, Mark?
Yeah, my gut tells me that going deep into talking about funding the EB-5 option, funding the Grenada option, and then funding the E2 investment is going to take more than the couple of minutes of time that we have left on this episode. It may sound like a cop-out, but I certainly wouldn't want to present incomplete information. But with the couple minutes that we do have left, I want to say, Rohit Turkud, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice. And do you have any parting advice to share with us?
Besides thanking you for the privilege and the pleasure of being on your podcast, I do want to assert, and I think we agree, that the doors to the U.S. are not closed. They are welcoming as they were before. They will always continue to be welcoming. I don't think people should be concerned about it. You just have to navigate the issue a little better, a little more smartly, and a little more wisely, and find your way through that open U.S. door. There just isn't another, a better door in the world.
I have to agree with you, Rohit. Thank you. Thank you so much. And we look forward to you having you on again on our
podcast.
Pleasure
will be always mine.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshahlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.